You are listening to a podcast from Raritan Valley Community College.
All right. Good morning, everybody. Good morning. There you go. Hi, my name is Daniel Lim. I'm from the New Jersey Community College Consortium. And what we do is we service the 19 community colleges to help them be one central voice for all the opportunities that are available at the local colleges, including what you guys got going on today. So first of all, I want to welcome you all to the financial literacy event that we're going to talk about. You guys are going to learn a lot of interesting things, and you're going to hear from one of the top-notch people at the Department of Banking, who's not only a policymaker, but someone who's dedicated his life to public service and financial awareness as well, too. So one thing I really want to stress is this event is for you guys, okay? We do this as an open forum. So whatever questions you may have about how credit or finance or anything in general applies to you, we want to hear about that today. Okay? Give you guys a little backstory. Before I was working for the colleges a lifetime ago, I worked for a little investment bank called Goldman Sachs. Anybody ever heard of them before? And I learned a lot. I learned a lot about what banking is. I learned about what banking isn't as well, too. But before that point, I was a college student, just like you guys. And, you know, my entire experience with credit and finance and interest rates and all that was a free T-shirt I got at a Flyers game to sign up for a credit card. You guys ever get solicitations like that before? A couple of you guys, right? Little did I know that there's these little things called APR and annual fees and service charges, which when I actually learned how it works, it was the worst deal in the world, okay? I still got my T-shirt, don't get me wrong, but I had like a 29% interest rate on like a $300 credit card behind that. Later on in life, I found out what that really meant. And I found out that the disadvantages of not doing your homework up front, of not asking the questions up front, cost me literally thousands of dollars in finance charges. I read a really interesting stat the other day, had to do with having good credit versus fair credit versus poor credit behind that. And it all affects how the interest rate that you get as a borrower of any kind of credit. And the stat was, if you have less than good credit, in your lifetime, you're going to wind up paying over $200,000 more on payments than you would if you had good credit, okay? And the advantage that we all have today is that we're young. So the good news is you haven't had enough time to rack up bad credit, right? Bad news is you probably don't have a whole lot of credit established, but that's something that you can work on today when you're in school behind that, things like student loans or things like secured credit cards, and you'll find out more information about that as well, too. You also hear from the gentleman at the Department of Banking how you can find out how you can get your credit score for free. And when I mean free, I don't mean those little blinking ads that say, get your free credit score, only $19.95, right? Or the ones that say they'll give you a free credit report if you buy Britney Spears tickets, half off, things like that. You can legitimately get it for free and find out what that means and how that affects you as well, too. Okay? So, guys, without further ado, I'm going to turn it over to your president from Enactus as well, and then he's going to go ahead and take the show from here. Thank you.
Thanks, Dan. And thank you, everyone, for coming to the last Enactus Flip series of the semester. I want to introduce Mr. Tom Honey. He's the Assistant Director of Banking for the Office of Consumer Finance from the New Jersey Department of Banking and Insurance. Such a long title, I had to print it out, actually. So without further ado, Mr. Tom Hunt.
Oh, boy. Can you hear me now? Great. It's set up for these tall guys. So thank you, Jack Ayer, for that kind introduction, and Daniel Lim, who's with the Community College or County College Consortium. I don't know if you have encountered him before, but he's a real dynamo, incredibly energetic, helping to foster and facilitate a lot of programs around the county colleges around the state. I happen to be a Hunterdon resident, so I'm delighted to be here at RVCC and see the very impressive facilities. I've never been in this room before. Obviously, a multi-purpose room, which is fiscally prudent, something I know my freeholders would approve of. So let me just this up a little bit so I don't have to lean over too much. I'm getting too old for that. So let me introduce myself again very briefly. My name is Tom Hunt. I run a 50-person shop within the little Department of Banking and Insurance. I say little because it's the smallest of all of the regular line departments of the state. But we like to think that we've got a pretty big impact for consumers where often it hurts most, in their pocketbook. Our department regulates insurance in the state, and so far, the states are where the action is as far as regulating insurance, health insurance, and property casualty insurance, like homeowners insurance, which became very much an issue after the hurricane, Sandy, and Irene as well. So our involvement with insurance matters, from regulating companies to handling individual consumer complaints, is basically our largest operation within our department. That's the division of insurance within our department. I work in the division of banking, which is a division that works in a world where we work in coordination, sometimes you might say competition, with the federal government, which also regulates banking in a very big way. I'm sure many of you may have heard about the Dodd-Frank Act in your lifetimes. So far, you haven't had to deal too much with regulations, I'm sure, and hopefully not. The Dodd-Frank Act was a congressional response to the financial crisis that kind of began in 2008. And what it did, among many other things, was to create a Consumer Financial Protection Bureau at the federal level that does many of the things that our department has done for the people of New Jersey. Now, they do it nationwide for everybody in every state. And so we cross paths with them all the time in our banking regulatory world. My particular corner of that division is the Office of Consumer Finance, as we call it, handles basically everything except for normal banks, depository banks, banks that are chartered by the state of New Jersey, that are insured by the FDIC, and that sort of thing. That's handled by our department, too, but that's across the hall. That's somebody else. So I handle the lenders who lend for a home purchase, residential mortgage lenders, we call them. We happen to regulate credit unions, the state-chartered ones. As many of you may know, there's a federally chartered credit union with an office right in facilities here, Affinity. The federally chartered credit unions we don't touch. But the federal agency that does regulate them works with us because they also insure credit union deposits the way the FDIC insures regular bank deposits. So we deal with them every day. So that's a little bit of background in a very broad brush sense about where I come from. One of my key duties over the years has been to handle consumer complaints. And you can bet that people come to us with complaints about everything under the sun relating to finances. Loans that they've taken out that have gone bad, or they've run into trouble making payments. Deposits that have problems. My shop actually handles that side as well. Sometimes you get people complaining about how the laws are just not adequate, and you know, you ought to, you know, throw in this amendment or that amendment to make them better. And sometimes we have to respond to them, if only to say, nope, not my job, talk to the legislature. And we talk with them a lot, too, the people in the legislature, about some of their plans and thoughts, and that sometimes find the form of a drafted bill. So the way I wanted to approach you here today was, after giving you that little picture of what I do, is to stick more or less to a script that I've been given at rather short notice about the kind of financial literacy issues that people in college should be aware of and take notice of. But then the most important part of a session like this, I think, is to have a Q&A session. I'm very happy to take questions about anything from what I would call micro financial literacy, that is, you know, balancing a checkbook of your own finances, to what I would call macro financial literacy, and that is maybe being able to understand the larger financial budgetary issues in the public sphere, at the state level, the federal level, whatever. I'm not a genius on that, but it's that's an interesting topic too, and people should take some care to understand some of the major differences between personal finances and public finances. It's a tricky transition from one to the other sometimes for a lot of people to understand. So that being said, I'm going to jump into these remarks, and I'm very happy to take any questions you might have along the way. But I'm glad to hear from, and I need a shout out to Tracy Rimple, who arranged for this, I think, this event, along with the Enactus people. And you may know Tracy in various ways, but I've just met her, and I'm very, very impressed with her role as an advisor to the Enactus program, I'm probably describing it wrong, that has a very lively presence here at RVCC. You should talk to her about what it's all about, because it's really interesting. But it's basically a program involving the students who sign up here, working with various on various projects with an entrepreneurial side to it, to try to bring any number of forms of help to people in this country and countries around the world to learn how to sort of how to fish rather than giving them a fish in economic terms. Seems like a really, really great program. But Tracy did happen to mention to me that that an awful lot of you have jobs, full-time jobs or part-time jobs, while working hard here at school. And so many of you, and because of that, probably have a pretty good grasp already of what it costs to be here, what you're earning out there in the job market, what parents or other good-hearted people may be willing to throw in to make it all happen, and how to balance all of that. But that's assuming that's happening for you, and you're if not pulling the strings and writing the checks and all that sort of yourselves, you should keep a very close eye on it, because it's a lesson you can carry with you through the rest of your lives as to how to make that happen. Because it, surprisingly enough, as you graduate and get into the workforce, you'll be doing much the same. It doesn't get different. There's still income and expenses. And that's a key thing to be mindful of and pay attention to now, because hopefully it's a relatively harmless time for you. I'm hoping you're not throwing wild expenses onto credit cards now, as Daniel was mentioning. That can be very tempting, but it can create a mess for you down the road as to your credit score, let alone digging out of a hole of debt. So I'm straying from my script horribly, but I'll let you know as to credit cards that there is a federal law that went into place in 2009 called the CARD Act. That's an acronym for the Credit Card Accountability Responsibility Disclosure Act, which is very typical of a lot of federal laws that don't limit charges on credit cards, don't limit the access to credit cards, but require disclosures so that consumers, as they obtain credit cards, get as much knowledge of their terms and conditions as possible right up front. So what does that do for you? Well, it means you have to pay attention to that to get the value of that particular law to protect you from what could be really terrible terms, which could be 29% on a $300 credit limit, which can build up very quickly into, if you're not paying it regularly or in full, very large amounts of debts kind of sitting there that you have to deal with. On that score, I'm going to jump to a kind of a war story about one of the my pet peeves and one of the things that my shop and the department has had to deal with on a regular basis for 8 or 9 years altogether. And that is not credit cards so much as what they call payday loans. Sometimes these loans come in the form of car title or auto title loans, where instead of just getting what you call an unsecured loan from your paycheck, you hand somebody your car title, and that's their security to make sure that you pay on time. Well, without getting too technical on you, in New Jersey, we have a law that requires consumer lenders of this kind who make payday loans to to get a license from us, which is really nice, subject themselves to examination by us from time to time, but most importantly, from the consumer perspective, to abide by, to comply with this state's usury code. Not all states have a usury code. How many of you know what usury is? Using that term. Well, usury is a word that goes way back in time, it's probably in the Bible for all I know, but it literally means the charging of interest at a rate beyond what is permitted, either by law or custom or tradition. In New Jersey, we have a law that dates back to the colonial times requires or limits the interest that can be charged per year on a loan to an individual, not a corporation, to 30%. That's a huge consumer protection. It's often abused, and then the law, the police sometimes, because this is a criminal usury code that we're talking about here, sometimes a civil regulatory agency like us will pursue people who have been charging beyond that amount. What happens with the payday lenders out there who exist largely online in New Jersey because they don't open up storefronts in this state because they can't get a license because they typically charge interest north of 400, 500, 600%, which gets people into hot water financially very quickly if they take out, for instance, a $300 loan in January with the promise to pay that back the beginning of February, your next paycheck. Well, let's say something happens, the car breaks down, there's another demand on what money you have, and you can't pay that. Well, there's usually a provision for a rollover of that initial loan and maybe another takeout or draw from the same source, but with an additional charge. And over time, if that amount is not paid off in full very promptly, you can end up with compounded interest and payments and amounts due in the thousands of dollars from an initial $300 loan. And we often get, as you can imagine, unhappy, distressed, embarrassed calls from and letters from people who have taken loans like this either by crossing the state lines into Delaware, where they don't have such limits, and taking it right there. And if they take a loan out in Delaware, we can't really help them because it was legal there. Or taking it out online, right here in New Jersey at their desktop, where we can help. And we often do. Though, and here's another financial fact for you, to be very careful with what you do online financially, partly because who's going to help you if things do go wrong? We try to help people who have taken out payday loans in New Jersey, maybe down the street, at their desktop, that have these usurious interest rates, and they may be facing thousands of dollars of collection efforts being thrown at them daily with phone calls and letters. And we can help a bit, but one of the problems with online lending of that kind, online financial transactions of any kind, is unless you're really sure that the entity you're dealing with at the other end is legitimate and, you know, hopefully based in the United States, if not in New Jersey, is that it's very hard for a regulator, for the FBI even, to reach them and to help you and get your money back. Because sometimes those entities are in completely foreign countries. often enough they are, or they're based sometimes, and I will have to be respectful about this because there are very legitimate economic activities by the tribal nations in this country, often, I think, mostly based in some of the western states. But legally, they can operate as independent sovereigns when it comes to economic activity within their particular reservations. There's no doubt about that, but there's a very unsettled law right now, status of the law, about how much they can export their lending activity through payday lending, for instance, into other states and not be affected by the usury code in New Jersey or other states. And therefore, it becomes difficult to get people refunds of sometimes the $10,000 or $20,000 that they may have already committed themselves to repaying to an entity out there. So buyer beware. Really need to be careful about what you do online. And in social media as well. I know you have got an Enactus group looking at social media, incredibly useful tool for marketing, et cetera, but you should know, especially as college students, that a lot of things that are placed on social media by you, and under your name anyway, is something that colleges will look at when they're looking at an application. And so as long as it's all good stuff, then you're fine, but these are things that go out there. They stay online or accessible to others forever. So that's one of my pet peeves with my own children. Say, don't do that. Now, before perhaps turning it over to questions, I'm going to touch on a couple of things in my very helpful script here that I'm sure are close to you. One is student loans. I would caution that as you go ahead to the next level after RVCC or while you're here, that you, if possible, choose a federally backed student loan rather than a private loan. There are plenty out there because of the guarantees involved, generally lower rates. And many of the federal programs, which your office here is probably very good at telling you all the information you would need about, have various deferral and income-based sort of repayment plans attached to them that private loans often don't have. So take advantage of that. That's a great thing to look into. And I'm sure you all have research tools, again, at your desktop or within the office here at the college to look into. The other thing I will mention, though, is the ACA, the Affordable Care Act. I think Daniel mentioned to me, are you going to mention that? And I think that's a very good point to make. It happens to be open right now for enrollment. And many of you probably know that kids to the age of 26, is it? 25, 26, can ride on their parents' health benefits package up until that point. But it doesn't mean you have to, and it's really worth looking into, getting it yourself if you're inclined. But there's an open enrollment period right now, which is a rare event. It's once a year at the most, and I'm not sure whether it's guaranteed every year. So if you're considering that or need that, do look into it. So that kind of concludes a march through my little prepared remarks. I will add, though, that when I go to work every day, one of the most satisfying things that I can do, sometimes frustrating, but satisfying things, is to catch a complaint from a particular consumer about her mortgage and how she's fighting foreclosure. And, there's a sheriff's sale coming up in a week. And what can you do to help us? And often enough, through what little persuasive powers I have, though we don't regulate in that area, I can bring the various parties involved, the creditor, the sheriff's office, the court, and say, what can we do, since they've come to us looking for help, to give one, you know, additional shot, one extension of time to see if the issues can be revisited and a solution can be found. Well, sometimes it works, sometimes a solution is found, but the most serious lesson that I learn every day with one of those particular cases is that, wow, wouldn't it have been better if that particular person had had a course like schools are required to teach now, like what Enactus is doing here, that gives you the tools that you need right up front to avoid getting into situations like that. So I would finish my formal remarks with a compliment to you for taking part in this kind of session here today, and to really take it seriously for your personal financial condition now, but also going forward. And you really need to think through major decisions like how to finance a house if you want to do that, even how to finance a car if you're going to do that. There's nothing wrong with taking out a loan for something that brings you a real dividend, like a home, place to live, a car, how to get to work, how to manage your life. But you have to be smart about the debt service, that is, the amount you're going to have to pay, and your ability to repay it. These are clearly basics. I will also put in a plug for something this is probably such an old-fashioned thing, but something my father taught me when I was just a wee lad, and that is the value of keeping either a paper or perhaps an online checkbook of your own expenses. Every time you write a check or you do a mobile transaction, I suppose, too, keep a running tally for your own purposes through, if you can do it, a double entry thing to know exactly where you are. Because you'd be surprised how many people we have coming to us with complaints about how their savings, their checking account is all wrong. Because they thought that the little readout that comes with an ATM slip after you've used that is a true read on how much money they have in their account, and so on and so forth, not taking into account the checks she might have written the day before that are outstanding out there and that will come in and take whatever amounts they are from her account right away. So nobody is more incentivized to be completely aware of your own account than yourself. So I really recommend doing that. I've tried mightily to convince my wife to do this, but I do it for us. And it's really made a big difference over time, I think, in being disciplined about exactly what we have and what we can commit here and what we can commit there and what we can't do. So with that little caution aside, I would be happy to take any questions about anything, big or small. Yes, sir. There's a microphone up front, too, if you want to.
I'll be out loud now. How do you suggest to build credit, a safe way to build credit as a college kid?
That's a good question. The question is how to safely build credit as a college kid. Well, first, let me assume that you, like others, are probably employed part-time or full-time, so you have some income. One way to do that is to keep a payment in full track record, if you can do it, on your credit card. The credit score industry, in fact, Daniel mentioned this too. How do you get your credit score for free? Well, there's a couple of ways to do that. And the easiest way I would tell you to do it is to go to the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau's website, which has a gateway to do that. So that's one way to measure how your credit score may be getting better over time by trying to do things to increase your credit worthiness. Now, depending on what you might need in your life, another way to build your credit score is to make a small purchase with a small consumer loan from your credit union or your bank. And I, by small, I mean something manageable for you, a couple thousand dollars, maybe for a new computer. You might have the credit card there and with a limit that would let you just buy it outright on the credit card, but you're going to pay a pretty high interest rate generally for that. So one way to build credit is to take out a small loan like that and pay it off on time or even a little bit ahead. Make sure it's manageable for you. And those are things that the credit rating agencies will look at, and they'll track that kind of thing. They know everything about you if you're in the credit card system. And they like to see it improved to the extent they like anything. They're really a sort of mathematically driven, so they don't have big likes and dislikes. But we like to see it. So good question. Sorry, there was another. Yes, sir.
This is like a two-part question. Are you familiar with net neutrality?
With what?
Net neutrality.
Net neutrality.
A net neutrality. So if I understand you, the question is about net neutrality and whether if net neutrality is maintained by legislation of some kind, I suppose.
If Internet providers are able to block certain, prefer other contacts over others, then would they be able to have, maybe some guy working for them that's looking out for any, scam websites that or, bad websites, and then maybe you can pay them an extra $5 a month? Then they'll be able to protect you from anywhere that might be harmful.
Well, now this is a little outside my area, but it's a good macro kind of question. And the question is whether if Internet providers, if I'm getting this right, are able to be selective in who they will carry or not carry, that's going to come with, I would assume, some additional revenue. And couldn't some of that be dedicated to an anti-fraud program of some kind? I think that would be a wonderful thing. I'm not sure whether they would do it unless the law required them to do it uniformly. But certainly to the advantage of any brand out there online to protect its brand by, for its own private business reasons, to eliminate or reduce the possibility of fraud being perpetrated through their means. So it could be a marketplace kind of driver to make that happen, but I wouldn't say that would be a substitute for each individual person at their desktop making sure you're not jumping into something that just is too good to be true or fishy in one way or another. There are tons of credits, threats. And in that regard, I'm sure many of you are very familiar with the breaches of personal data on out there with some of the big box stores, et cetera, et cetera. But a lot of that gets big news, but what is the dirty secret for the past several years is that there are hits on these databases in the thousands every single day. And some hit bigger pay dirt than others, but the vast majority of them are identified and contained very quickly, and then some of them are much more successful. But that's a constant. And there's a technique for gaining somebody else's credit card information that some of you may know about. I couldn't begin to explain how it happens technologically, but it's called skimming. And a little device that looks very much like the credit card swipe thing that you might use at a gas station or any kind of retail store can be placed right over the actual one by a clever criminal. And it looks just perfectly normal, but what it does is it picks up your information straight from your card, and instead of having that information piped to the place you think it's going to the gas company, to the store owner, it goes to these clever people. And what they do is collect credit card information by the thousands that way. What one individual person can do about that, I frankly don't really know. It's a very system-related kind of issue. What generally happens is if you, by regulation, if a credit card issuer, Bank of America or Wells Fargo, whoever it happens to be, through their software programs, recognize charges on your card that are outside the normal sort of basket of things that you charge for, they are required, in fact, to ask you if this is a legitimate charge, flag it initially, and then you know, if you don't respond within a couple of days, they're going to take pretty much immediate action to cancel your card to protect you and protect them, because they have to eat that charge that came in that was wrongly placed on your card. So that's kind of your protection for the results of skimming to a certain extent. I wouldn't even recognize a little skimmer if I saw one on a gas, whatever you call it, or a retail store card swipe. I wouldn't even see it. Or even at my own ATM at the bank that I go to. Unless it was done really badly, I just wouldn't even recognize it. And I think 99.9% of the people wouldn't. So the protection for consumers really has to come at the back end from those credit card issuers who might be able to do something about it systemically by changing systems a little bit, but can bear the burden of actually keeping you held harmless from this kind of activity. And that's by law, so it's not something industry is probably all that thrilled about, but the incentive for them is to work hard at fraud protection at the sort of system-wide level, too, which we cannot, as individuals, really do very effectively. So how did I get into that? Good question. Any other questions? Yes, sir.
Sometimes students have, I'm a counselor with the workforce programs, and sometimes students I find drop out and say, you know, I didn't quite get it, that it was going to cost this much, and my girlfriend moved out on me, and she was helping me pay and like that, so I have to drop out. And I say, well, no, actually, take a look at these plans. You know, you can take out some loans. They're like, no, I don't want to take any loans. I don't want any debt. So a student faces sometimes a decision. Either I get some debt, and then I'm going to have to pay back. And my daddy told me never, ever, you know, neither a borrower nor a lender be, or whatever it is, you know. But on the other hand, I'm stopping my education so that I can go out and work, you know, for whatever it is, $8.25 an hour or something. And then I'll be back. And often I don't see a student back. And my question is, financially, what is, I only have my own opinions, but you have experience, so what's a wise thing? Is it, where do I know when to go into debt and when to say, no, I don't want to go into debt, I want to go and work and save money so that I can go to school and yada, yada?
Well, great question, and a sort of leading question, I think.
Well, I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong.
Well, no, that's okay.
Yeah.
Because I'm a great believer in education and the power of education and the investment that education is in your lives. You all probably believe that too right now, but I have encountered in my own life people who have gone through exactly that same sort of scenario that you were describing with a young man who felt, I don't want any debt. I want to get this done without a pile of debt on my back, or I'm not going to do it. You know, everybody's going to be different, and some people may have no tolerance for debt whatsoever, and then you have to live with the consequences of that kind of non-investment choice. So I would err on the side of saying if if the numbers add up that they're going to be manageable when that bill comes due for the loan, then I think it's a very wise investment. I wish I could trot out the kind of figures that you read about how the income levels of people who have finished a two-year, four-year degree compared to people who have not. And there's a very substantial difference over time in among the big numbers of a population. You know, individuals are always going to be different. But I would say it's a good investment, even if there is a debt that has to be paid over time. Again, if you've taken out a federal loan, there are various kinds of deferrals and repayment plans that you can get into to soften the blow a little bit if that's a problem, if it becomes a problem down the road. But, I think that's, borrowing for ultimate returns is okay. Before, I guess, the 1920s and 30s, especially when with the advent of what we know of today as like the 30-year mortgage and borrowing in order to own a home, there was very little in the way of standardized lending around buying a house. And by far, most people bought a house the old-fashioned way. Either they inherited it from their parents or they bought it with cash. And housing probably wasn't quite the same costly item that it is today for a whole lot of market reasons. But it was through the mechanism of the mortgage loan that people were able to buy houses. And even in the worst of the 2008-2010 financial crisis, the numbers of people who were in foreclosure, although greatly over what they had been, still was, say, 10%, depending on where you lived and where you were, which state, lots of different experiences out there. So what that means is that 9 out of 10 people who took out a mortgage loan were managing to do it and got the benefit of that through having a house, hopefully gaining some kind of value, though that's been a problem as well. For homes, anybody who buys a brand new car, as far as auto lending goes, knows that as soon as you drive it off the lot, the resale value drops. So you have to there kind of weigh whether at when you're starting off, whether you want to buy a new car at all and see that happen or buy a used car. But it's really not practical to buy a used education. And it's not really practical to buy something other than the full education that you really want, because if you do that, it's going to pay dividends over time, almost certainly. So I think that's a worthwhile investment myself. yes, sir. Well, good question. The online lenders that offer their loan products around the entire country, if not the world, where they lend in New Jersey, New York State, or Pennsylvania, say they're doing it out of North Dakota, make it really easy, a place where a lot of credit card companies are located because there is no usury code. So they can charge whatever interest they want there. Well, if the transaction actually happens here, then we like to think that we have jurisdiction over them and we could stop it. But the flip side of that is that they believe they can come into New Jersey and use New Jersey mails, New Jersey courts even, to enforce their rights to collect. And the answer is, as far as relief for a New Jersey person anyway, if they think of it, they may call us or write to us at the department and say, I've really gotten over my head here. I think these terms and conditions, this interest rate was terrible. Help. In the meantime, they may have pulled out several hundred, if not thousands of dollars through this loan, but they owe even more. Well, what they may not realize until we tell them is that the loan was pretty much illegal right from the get-go, and we can get sometimes a relatively conscientious lender in another state to refund amounts and to hold them harmless as to anything more. But that doesn't always work because I don't have a unit of, you know, secret police that I can send over to another state to tell them they've got to stop this. A lot of it's persuasive powers. Information and disclosures on our part, on our website or other places that such and such a lender is acting illegally in this state and therefore shouldn't be touched. But, you know, who sees that? We're not going to put those ads on TV. It's way too expensive for us. So, again, it comes round to an educated consumer being their best advocate for themselves by doing a little modest due diligence whenever you want to go online or anywhere for a financial product, a loan in particular, to either look at our website, look at the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau's website, the Federal Trade Commission's website is also a great source of information about entities out there that have a track record of bad behavior. The Better Business Bureau is another one. You can just plug in the name, see is this legitimate or not, and you can learn a lot about whether it is or not. We also have a source of information about lenders and other entities in New Jersey that are licensed by us. So if you have a name that you plug into our online service, you can find out whether they are licensed as an insurance producer, for instance, or a check casher or a money transmitter. So there are ways to sort of protect yourself with that little bit of due diligence. Good question. Any other? Yes, sir. Well, you know, I've seen some of those commercials, and I don't really have any direct experience with them. People don't come to us about it. They probably, if they have a problem with it and they've tried it and it hasn't worked, they may go to the real IRS or a federal agency and complain. But my understanding, anyway, is that most of those ads are by law firms and really to represent a third party, you know, you or a consumer in that sort of situation, generally you'd need a lawyer. And I'm probably not authorized to talk about lawyer advertising. Yes, Daniel? And Daniel has an excellent point. Not only the IRS, but most lenders, big banks especially, have hotlines that you can call to tell them that, you know, I'm hitting a rough patch. What can you do for me? I know I'm going to miss this payment or that payment. Let's talk it through. It's always the first call you should make is to them. They may not be real happy about it, but they'd rather know and work with you, especially for a short-term kind of issue, than not. And you'll do better with them, usually cost-free, than by going to a third-party service provider of some kind who may claim to be able to help you and will charge you quite a lot right up front, whether they help you or not. And in that regard, one of the key sources of complaints we've heard over time is with what we call mortgage loan modification scams, where hopefully you won't have to deal with this directly yourselves, but somebody's very much behind in their mortgage loan and looking at a foreclosure complaint or already in the process of foreclosure, and they answer an ad or they They look for a loan modification assistance from a private third party. If they charge up front for these services, more likely than not, they're not legitimate, so I would always avoid them. There are actually federal rules out there saying you can't do that, but some of them still do. Some people still bite at that bait. Usually those entities do not perform. They don't help people at all. They manage to operate in a certain little niche area for a few months, then collect all the money they can, pack themselves up, physically move their office, change their web address, all those sort of things so that nobody can find them. And in fact, it's very hard to find them. Sometimes not impossible, but very hard. And most of those people who have been ripped off by them have very little in the way of any kind of source for a refund. So again, buyer beware, think it through. There are licensed debt adjusters, as we call them in New Jersey, which are listed on our website. If somebody needs that kind of service, they're very good. They don't charge anything up front. They may charge small amounts for costs and things like that, but it's not thousands of dollars. And they have a very good proven track record of helping people through those sort of situations and individual situations and handing them ultimately a sort of educational package with meetings to make sure that people kind of understand this to result in a budget that can serve them well over the long haul. Another good question. I don't want to keep you all. We have this room till about now, I guess, right? Anything else? I'll take one more. Yes, ma'am.
What is one thing that you would suggest for us college students to do now in terms of budgeting and saving?
Ah. Well, I'm glad you asked that because I heard during the session earlier with Enactus that somebody had opened up I think a Roth IRA at this young age, looking towards retirement. Well, I wish I had done that, because if you start saving early in something like that, and a Roth IRA is usually funded, I think has to be funded with post-tax dollars. It's not a deferred compensation thing where maybe your pre-tax pay goes into a bucket. But if you have a job that offers deferred compensation of that kind, that's another great savings vehicle, because that money hasn't been taxed, sits there for a very long time, earning not interest, it's usually invested, so it can grow. Roth IRAs do the same thing, but it's post-tax dollars, so the full amount, interest and principal, is yours to take when the magic time comes. Regular savings accounts, compounded, the beauty of compound interest over time, even though we're in an incredibly low interest rate environment right now, is amazing. So every bit of saving that you can do in these various vehicles early will really set you up very well, even if the rewards look way off. Believe me, I wish I had done it. So with that, I want to thank you very much for having us. Best of luck in your future endeavors. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Tom Hunt. Can we give another round of applause, please? He came all the way from Trenton to speak to us. Very important man. I appreciate it a lot. There's two boxes of pizza left.